This is Rabbi Josh Yoder of the Stanton Street Shul. Thank you for downloading this class podcast. These classes are provided free of charge through the generosity of the Stanton Street Shul community and supporters like you. If you do enjoy them, please consider making a donation to our synagogue's building fund on our website's shop donate page at www.stantonstshul.com. Good evening. It is Tuesday, June 19th, 2012. Topic for tonight for Machshevet Chazal, Rabbinic Thought and Theology, is a question of theodicy and the problem of evil. This is a big topic that pretty much any religion is going to have to address. Mostly centering around the question of if God is all-powerful, God is all-knowing, and God is good, how could there possibly be evil in the world? Colloquially, people will say things like, well, why do bad things happen to good people, or why do good things happen to bad people? When you have God that makes certain promises, in this case, the Jewish God makes promises in the Bible that can often be reduced to do the commandments and good things are going to happen to you, do bad things and bad things are going to happen to you. But our observation as we go through the world is that the world just plain doesn't work like that. You find some good people who have very hard lives, and you have some people who seem really bad who live really good lives. And these are, it's a huge question that, has to be addressed. And that's going to be the point today. One way that I, came across this particular topic was, it was something that my professor and Rebbe Dr. Yaakov Ellman wrote about, but when I was in Chicago, University of Chicago, I had taken a class in a divinity school on the problem of evil. And the professors, two of whom were very well-renowned in the field of religion, were saying things like, here's the Jewish position on evil, because they were reading a translation of Eov, the book of Job, which annoyed me immensely, not as an Orthodox Jew or even as a rabbi at Gan Smicha a year earlier, but as a grad student, that you have two individuals who are world-renowned in their respective fields, neither one of whom really knew Hebrew, who are making a really irresponsible statement that this is the Jewish position on evil. As we're going to see today, the point is, there isn't going to be an answer in the sense that you normally think of it. And we're going to develop this through a range of different approaches to this question of how there is evil or divine evil in the world, or in a broader sense, divine justice. Now, I'll start off just by two things of introduction. Is one from Tehillim, Book of Psalms 92:7-8, Mizmor Shel Yom HaShabbat. If Ish Ba'ar Lo Yida Uchsil Lo Yavin Atzot Beforach Rishaim Kamo Isev V'Yatzitzu Kol Po Ali Aven Lisham Edama Deyad. That the senseless man does not know, fools don't understand, that though the wicked spring up like grass and evildoers flourish, they will be forever destroyed. So there's already a biblical addressing of the question, trying to get across that at some point, evildoers are going to get their comeuppance. Right? Aaron, could you please take Mishnah Avot 4:15?
Rabbi Yana used to say, it is not in our power to explain the well-being of the wicked, or the sorrows of the righteous.
Yeah, sorrows isn't a great translation. It should really be, punishment. Well, punishment or tribulations or something like that. So he says, "Ein bi'adenu." He says it's not in our hands. So, right off the bat, wanted to, throw in a relatively early source where Rabbi Yonai just kind of gives up. And he says, No answer that we're going to give is going, or, we're never going to fully understand this. And it's a really honest type of, theological statement. Of course, it's not, even though he makes that statement of Ein Bi'adenu, doesn't stop people, from trying. So when we think about what is the problem of evil and the justice of evil, I want to do it progressively. The first idea that I wanted to bring up is an idea of divine justice in the most extreme form. And for this, the Hebrew term is midah keneged midah, known colloquially as measure for measure. Here's an example, and stated explicitly. This is Mishnah in Sota, chapter 1, 7 through 9, and skipping a bit. B'midah she'adam oded ba modedin lo. A person is treated according to his own behavior. And that goes through a bunch of examples. She, the Sota woman, dressed for sin, and she became uncovered. She revealed her sin, so God revealed her sin. She sinned with her thigh and then her belly, therefore her thigh is hit first and then her belly. Samson followed his eyes by taking a Philistine woman, and so the Philistines put out his eyes. Absalom took pride in his hair, so he was hung by his hair. Since he came to his father's 10 concubines, 10 spears were thrust into him. Since he stole 3 hearts, the heart of his father, the heart of the court, and the heart of Israel, so he was in his heart with 3 sticks. 3 sticks, excuse me. This rule applies for good, meaning rewards, as well. Miriam waited for Moses 1 hour, and so Israel waited for her for 7 days. Joseph, the greatest of the brothers, buried his father, and so Moses, the greatest of Israel, took it upon himself to bring up Joseph's bones. Right? So midah keneged midah isn't just, you know, you get punished for your sin, but there is a direct correlation in terms of how you are punished with how you sinned. And the same thing applies for rewards, too. Take the next example. This is Mishnah Avot 2:6.
He, Rabban Gamliel, once saw a skull floating on the water. He said to it, "Because you drowned another, so too you were drowned. And ultimately, those who drowned you will themselves be drowned."
All right, continuing that pattern. You know, someone drowns, someone else is going to drown afterwards. Right? Also, getting this idea of midah connected midah. If, you know, this person, you know, only drowned because he must have drowned someone else, and then the cycle is going to perpetuate. Mishnah Avot, chapter 5, 8, and 9. There are 7 types of punishments for 7 types of sins. 1, if sometime, and some do not, a famine of drought comes such that some will be hungry and others will not. If everyone does not tithe, then a famine of both armed robbers and drought will come. If they also did not take challah, then a destructive drought will come. Pestilence comes to the world for those people who deserve the death penalty, but were not given over to the court, and for misuse of sabbatical produce. The sword comes to the world for delay of justice, the perversion of justice, and for teaching Torah in opposition to Jewish law. Wild beasts come to the world for meaningless oaths, for desecration of God's name. Exile comes to the world for idolatry, licentiousness, murder, for not observing the sabbatical years. So for some of these, you know, there may be a direct correlation, more of the midah keneged midah, in terms of how you sin and how you're punished. For example, if you sin, you know, through tithing, which is an agricultural law, then you're going to get punished through a lack of agriculture. Not everything really matches up, meaning, you know, sword for justice, delay of justice, and, you know, teaching Torah in opposition to Jewish law. I mean, that teaching Torah in opposition to Jewish law is kind of broad, you know, to say the least. But you may be able to say, well, that has to deal with justice, and justice is enforced by the sword. Pushes it a little, but, you know, at least some of them kind of, you know, match up, where, you know, there's a certain type of sin for certain types of punishments. The corollary is set. So, you know, that's the first section. The next section deals with sin, or not sin, punishments or bad things happening as a means of a general atonement, or punishment as a means of atonement. So, Marilyn, could you please take Gemara Sanhedrin 37b?
But the law of the 4 modes of execution was not abolished. He who is worthy of stoning either falls from the roof, or is trampled to death by a wild beast. He who merits burning either falls into the fire or is bitten by a serpent. He who is worthy of decapitation is either delivered to the Gentile government or brigands attack him. He who is worthy of strangulation is either drowned in a river or dies of suffocation.
Right, so kind of in this respect, you have arba mitot beitin. You've got 4 capital punishments that a beitin could impose on someone and can enact and use to execute someone. According to this Gemara, that even though a beitin lacks the authority, that doesn't mean that the punishments still aren't there. And here it gives examples of Other types of ways that someone can die, ostensibly of natural causes or unnatural causes, but certainly nothing supernatural, nothing through the court. But according to this Gemara, if you did something that you are worthy of one of the Arba Mitot Beit in one of the four types of death, God's going to get you in another way, which means something ostensibly bad can happen to you. Why did that happen? Well, one possibility is, well, you did something that warranted the death penalty, so God's getting you this way. Gemara Nechulin 7b, Rabbi Hanina said, no man bruises his finger on earth unless it was decreed against him by heaven. For it is written, the salvation of the righteousness comes from the Lord, and he has stronghold in their time of trouble. And a man's steps are directed by the Lord. How could anyone understand his own way? Rav Elazar said, the blood of a bruise atones like a burnt offering. Rava said, it is only the blood of a second bruising of the thumb atones, and only if he was about to perform a commandment. All right. So a bit of a dispute over bruising, but you have a few opinions here that says, well, even something is... Well, first take Rabbi Hanina's statement. Even something is trivial. Let's take today. You stub your toe on the bed, right? I've done that, God, far too many times that I should really admit, right? So according to this Gemara, it's, well, already decreed by heaven that was going to happen. And according to Rav Elazar, it's, you know, even something like that serves as a means of atonement. So, you know, you could say that, well, maybe did you deserve it or did you not deserve it? Well, there could be a plus side to it too, which is that it's serving a purpose. That the physical pain that you experience now can somehow help your spiritual ledger. Here's a great Gemara from Ketubot 30a to B. Myron, take this one.
But are cold and heat by the hand of heaven? Is it not taught? Everything is by the hand of heaven, except cold and heat. For it is said, cold and heat are in the way of the froward.
Or probably should be forward, but probably just pays
that.
Yeah, it's a Cincino translation. Not a great
that
one.
He that keepeth his soul, holdeth himself far from them. Further, are lions and thieves by the hand of man? Did not Rabbi Yosef say, and Rabbi Hiyai teach, since the day of the destruction of the temple, although the Sanhedrin ceased, the four forms of capital punishment have not ceased?
We saw that in the previous Gemara, but it's, you know, elaborating on that point.
They have not ceased, you say. Surely they have ceased. But say the judgment of the four forms of capital punishment has not ceased. He who would have been sentenced to stoning either falls down from the roof or a wild beast treads him down. He who would have been sentenced to burning either falls into a fire or a serpent bites him. He who would have been sentenced to decapitation is either delivered to the government or robbers come upon him. He who would have been sentenced to strangulation is either drowned in the river or dies from suffocation. But reverse it. Lions and thieves are by the hand of heaven, and cold and heat are by the hand of man.
Right. So you actually have a few differences here. They're kind of subtle in terms of what equals what. But again, you have an idea that lions and thieves are by the hand of heaven. I mean, if someone gets eaten to death by lions or, you know, set upon them by thieves, then, you know what? According to this Gemara, that's somehow sent by God for some reason or another. This is a really important Gemara for another point that, you know, we're not going to spend too much time on in this class. And that is, you've got two really important theological ideas in Judaism that are unfortunately mutually exclusive. One of them is divine providence, where God is in control of everything, hashgacha pratit. And the other is free will, bechira chofshit. Right? So normally, like, people are more familiar with the idiom, hakol bidei shamayim chutz miyirat shamayim. Everything is in the hands of heaven except for the fear of heaven. Whereas according to this Gemara, it's hakol bidei shamayim chutz mitzinim pachim. Right? Everything is in the hands of heaven except for, you know, cold and heat. Right? Now, the implication is this, and it's something that we don't really, you know, it doesn't come up in many discussions about theodicy, which is maybe bad stuff happens to you because you just didn't take care of yourself. So let's say cold and heat. Let's say it's the middle of winter. You live in Siberia. You decide to go out in shorts and a t-shirt, and you catch pneumonia. That's not God's fault. that's your fault because you didn't put on a jacket. There are certain things where, you know, it's not a matter of God intervening as much as a natural consequence of, you know, what someone did. Now, this is not a universal, you know, type statement, but it's an important element that has to be included in any discussion of evil, which is free will. How much of it is really something that is unfair versus, you know, you just went outside without a jacket and you caught a cold. Next time, dress for the elements type thing. All right? Let me do a few more of these because we've got a lot of stuff here. There's a Gemara in Shabbat, and we're going to revisit this, but it's important to include this opinion independently. Ravami said, there is no death without sin and no suffering without iniquity. There is no death without sin, for it is written, the soul sinneth, it shall die. The son shall not bear the iniquity of the father with him, neither shall the father bear the iniquity of the son with him. The righteousness of the righteous shall be upon him, and the wickedness of the wicked shall be upon him, according to Pasuk from Ezra 18:20. There is no suffering without iniquity, for it is written, then I will visit their transgressions, transgression with the rod, the iniquity with the strokes, from Tehillim, Psalms 89:33. So according to the opinion of Ravami, very extreme position when you think about it. It's anyone who died must be because of sin. Any punishment or suffering has to be associated with some sin or iniquity. We're going to revisit this Gemara in a later section, but at least here you have an opinion that states very emphatically any form of suffering is tied to sin. Finally, in this section, Gemara in Horiot 10b, Rav Nachman ben Chisda made the following exposition. What is meant by the scriptural text? There is vanity upon which is done upon the earth. There are righteous men unto whom it happened according to work of the wicked. And again, there are wicked men to whom it happens, etc. Happy are the righteous men unto whom it happens in the world according to the work of the wicked in the world to come. Woe to the wicked man whom it happened in this world according to the work of the righteous in the world to come. Said Rava, would the righteous then, if they enjoyed both the worlds, find it so distasteful? But, said Rava, happy are the righteous men unto whom it happened in this world according to the work of the wicked in this world. Woe to the wicked men unto whom it happened in this world according to the work of the righteous in this world. All right, so to explain that briefly, let me explain the thing with this world and that world. One explanation, a solution to the problem of theodicy is simply this, that you've got two worlds. You've got this world and an Olam Haba, a world to come. Whole separate classes on what Olam Haba is, but at some point in the future, right? Either, let's say it's a physical realm at some point later, which, you know, we discuss some ideas about in another class, or let's assume it's a metaphysical realm. Both of them would assume this. When you have a question about evil, that the divine scales don't seem to be balanced, the wicked prosper and the righteous suffer, one matter of faith is, well, at some later point, it's all going to even out. Might be after you die, but there's always going to be that accountability. So, you know, Rava spins it around a little and he says, you know, wait a second. You know, why? What would be so bad if the righteous would also get a reward in this world? So Rava then switches it to say, happy the righteous men who in this world, they get all the good stuff just as the wicked would. Meaning, you would expect a righteous person to be rewarded ultimately in the future, right? But he can say, well, you know, fortune out of the righteous who also get rewarded in the present. All right? So in this section, just wanted to show how things like death and suffering, one approach is that they're somehow, you know, they're all from God, but somehow some measure of either atonement or punishment or divinely ordained. In the third section, I want to deal with something that's theologically very problematic. It's called vicarious atonement. In other words, one person is being punished for the sin of someone else. Doesn't sound like a very Jewish idea, right? You would think that each one has their own ledger. But here are a couple of Gemara that seem to, you know, include vicarious atonement as a possibility. One is Yevamah 105a. There was a family in Jerusalem whose members died at 18. They came and told Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai. He said, maybe you are of the family of Eli, to whom it was said, and the increase of your family does as young men. Go study Torah and you may live. They went and studied Torah and they lived. So according to this, you had a family that the members kept dying young because the family of Eli, who, you know, way back in Shmuel Aleph, was cursed for pretty much an abuse of authority, right? We're still paying the price many, many generations later, right? I mean, you're talking about, you know, Eli happened at the very beginning of Shmuel Aleph, right? And Rav Yochanan, you know, Ben Zakkai is a Tana. So you've got several hundred years of stuff that happened in the interim. And according to this, he said, well, learn Torah and you'll be okay. But if they didn't learn Torah, it seems like they would have been punished for the sins of the ancestor. Mm-hmm. Take the Gemara in Brachot 7a, please.
The Master said above, the righteous man who prospers is a righteous man, son of a righteous man. The righteous man who is in adversity is a righteous man, son of a wicked man. But this is not
so. This is not so. Yeah.
For lo, one verse says, visiting the iniquities of the fathers upon the children. And another verse says, neither shall he, the children, be put to death for the fathers. And a contradiction was pointed out between these two verses, and the answer was given that there is no contradiction. The one verse deals with children who continue in the same course as their fathers, and the other verse with children who do not continue into the course of their fathers. You must therefore say that the Lord said thus to Moses, a righteous man who prospers is a perfectly righteous man. The righteous man who is in adversity is not a perfectly righteous man. The wicked man who prospers is not a perfectly wicked man. The wicked man who is in adversity is a perfectly wicked man. Now, this saying of Rabbi Yohanan.
You could stop there. Okay. I should probably cut that last part out. But yeah, so this explains, you know, the verse on bringing, you know, the sins of the father onto the children. Mm-hmm. So according to this Gemara, if the kids do what the parents do, then they get a double whammy, right? And you can say, well, why don't you just be, or at least it makes some, you know, you're still in some way, well, let's put this, you're still in some way getting punished for the sins of the father in a weird way. It's not just about you. But it does make a, you know, an important distinction here about that. Moed Katan 28a, Rav Ami said, what is the account of the death? Why is the account of the death of Miriam placed next to the loss of the red heifer? To inform you that even as the red heifer afforded atonement, so does the death of the righteous afford atonement. Rav Elazar said, why is the account of Aaron's death followed closely by the laws of disposal of priestly garments? To inform you that just as the priest's garments were means to effect atonement, so is the death of the righteous afford atonement. All right, so here, right, righteous people die, and that serves as an atonement for everyone else. Now, you could argue that the righteous from here, well, you know, maybe it's just righteous people are going to die, right? Righteous people aren't immortal. You know, unless you want to hold like Rav Ami that, you know, they still sin, so no one's 100% righteous. But at any rate, you know, righteous, you could say that, well, it just so happens that when they die, other people can be forgiven for their sins, but it's not that God's actively trying to seek out righteous people to kill. Similarly, you've got a Gemara in Sanhedrin 39a. A certain man said to Rabbi Abahu, your God is a jester. For he said to Ezekiel, lie down on your left side, and is also written, lie down on your right side. Just then a disciple came and asked him, what is the reason for the sabbatical year? Now, said Rabbi Abahu, I shall give you an answer which will suit you both equally. The Holy One, blessed be he, said to Israel, sow your seed 6 years, but omit the seventh, so that you may know that the earth is mine. They, however, did not do so, but they sinned and they were exiled. Now it is universal practice that a king of flesh and blood against whom his subjects have rebelled, if he be cruel, kills them all. If he is merciful, he slays half of them. But is he exceptionally merciful, he only chastises the great one. So also the Holy One, blessed be he, afflicted Ezekiel in order to cleanse Israel from their iniquities. Well, that kind of shoots the previous theory down. According to this, God actually, in fact, punished Yechezkel, right, because of the sins of the Jewish people. That's, you know, pretty big statement right there. I mean, you've got, you know, the suffering servant from Isaiah 53 that Christians, you know, says like, hey, this is the idea of this Christ figure who goes and suffers for your sins. Boom, according to this Gemara, you've got Yechezkel being the patsy, where he God will actually punish him because of what the Jewish people do.
So this feeds into that other religion.
Well, I don't know if they'll actually cite this. All I'm showing here is that the idea of vicarious atonement, of someone being punished for someone else's sins, appears in the Gemara. That's the only statement I'm making, and I can prove it just from here. Another wild, wild opinion from Gemara Shabbat 33b. Rabbi Gurion, or some say Rabbi Joseph, the son of Reb Shemaiah, said, when there are righteous men in a generation, they are taken for the sins of the generation. When there are no righteous in a generation, school children are taken for the generation. Now think about that for a second before we go on. According to that opinion, right? Again, righteous, it's not that just righteous, the death of the righteous serves as an atonement for the nation, but they're actually punished because of the sins of the nation. And if no one's righteous, school children die for the sins of the nation. Now, today, that's a pretty, you know, harsh type of statement right there, right? It's probably going to, you know, raise a whole lot more questions. So, just in the sphere of divine justice, where somehow punishment's equated for sin, we have three different models. One is that punishments are measure for measure, where that not only you punished in direct correlation for a sin, but you could be punished in a similar way that correlated to how you sin. We saw a bunch of other sources that dealt with punishment as some general sense for sin, or bad things happening as a means of punishment or otherwise coming from God, but because you did something wrong. And then we saw some other sources, well, you could be punished, or someone could be punished for someone else's sins. And that's a way that bad things can happen, that it's not just about you, not just about God measuring it up for you, but it could be some other party. And that's all the justice part. Section 3, moving along to a different side, is randomness of evil, right? Maybe it has nothing to do with how good or bad of a person you are. Gemara Bava Kama 60a, Rav Yosef learned, what is the meaning of the verse? And none of you shall go out at the door of the house until morning. Once permission has been granted to the destroyer, he does not distinguish between righteous and wicked. Moreover, he even begins with the righteous at the very outset, as it says, I will cut off from thee the righteous and the wicked. Rav Yosef wept at the sayings, so much are they compared to nothing. But Abai, consoling them, said, this is for their advantage. As it is written, the righteous is taken away from the evil to come. So, according in the Hebrew, it's Kevin Shenitan Rishut Lemashchit Eino Mavchin Ben Tzadikim Rishaim. Once God sort of lets the gates open, doesn't matter, right? At that point, there's no distinction between wicked and righteous. Right? So it's quite possible either wrong place or right time. And it does add here, well, actually, you know what? The righteous people would even get taken first, but getting killed first in this regard is actually a reward, so you don't see the suffering that's going to come afterwards. Interesting way of looking at it. You take the next one. This is a great Gemara in Chagiga 4b to 5a.
Is there anyone who passes away before his time? Yes. As in the story by Rabbi Bar Abaye, who would visit the angel of death. Once the angel of death said to his messenger, go bring me Miriam the hairdresser. The messenger went and returned with Miriam the children's nurse. The angel of death said to his messenger, I told you Miriam the hairdresser. The messenger replied, if so, I will take her back. Since you brought her, let her be added. The angel asked his messenger, but how were you able to get her? He answered, she was holding a shovel in her hand and was heating and breaking the oven. She put it on her foot and burnt herself. Since her luck was impaired, I brought her.
Yeah. So two really, you know, wacky paragraphs here. So the first one is the angel, I mean, we can debate whether or not this is an actual, you know, factual you know, type of historical case, but for the purposes of evil and the questions of punishment, it's a very important thing. So it raises up from the question of, is there anyone who passes away before their time? And the answer is yes. Now, the narrative seems, you know, kind of funny. You know, the angel of death doesn't actually do it himself, but he sends a messenger, and the messenger brings back the wrong person, right? So right off the bat, that seems to indicate that there's some degree of randomness, but also look at how. Right, that she had burnt herself, and it says ve'itra mazla, that her luck was somehow impaired and became worse, and that made her vulnerable to outside forces. Me, it seems like a fairly, you know, sense of randomness that, you know, she died not because she was good or bad, not because of reward or punishment, but through stranger circumstances that have nothing to do with it.
Superstitious, her luck.
It gets better. Gemara Moed Katan 28a. Rava said, length of life, children, and sustenance depend not on merit, but rather on mazel. Chayai benai mizonai lo bizkuta talia milta ela b'mazla talia milta. For take Rabba Bar Chista, Rabba and Rav Chista, I'm sorry. Both were saintly rabbis. One master prayed for rain and it came. The other master prayed for rain and it came. Rav Chista lived to the age of 92. Rabba only lived to the age of 40. In Rav Chista's house, there were 60 marriage feasts. At Rabba's house, there were 60 bereavements. At Rav Chista's house, there was the purest wheaten bread for dogs, and it went to waste, meaning he had so much wealth that even the best bread went to the dogs. At Rabba's house, there was barley bread for humans, beings, and that not to be had, meaning they could barely even get the lowest quality wheat, right? So this is a really, you know, important sugya here. Dr. Yaakov Elman found an analogy of this in some Middle Persian text that he likes citing. Well, let's look at the context here. You have Rabba, who sees two of his rabbis, both of whom are ostensibly tzaddikim, both of whom are righteous. One of them lives a really good life, the other really doesn't. So what does he do? He sees that the world isn't quite just, as he puts it, because these two people are righteous. Why is one good and one, you know, living a good life and the other a bad life? So he attributes it to mazel, which have a whole separate class on in its own right. But there's something that means that the suffering that someone doesn't that someone receives in this world is independent of righteousness. That there's some other outside factor that.
Can you explain briefly what mazel is then?
No, that would take another hour. Well, I guess I can do it briefly. As I understand mazel in rabbinic literature, and that there's, and trust me, there's a whole other class on that too, is it's used to indicate something that is not in divine hands, meaning it's not God actively doing something like in this particular case, but it's also outside of the realm of humans. Meaning it's neither man's actions that led it, and it's not God intervening. Even for a better analogy, it could very well be nature. Meaning
heavenly
this is,
bodies.
Well, I wouldn't call it heavenly bodies as much as this is just, you know, the world acting in its own way. That's a super simplification. It'll take about an hour to go through that more detail. So this is, you know, and this source serves as a nice segue to our next section, even though theologically Rav is acknowledging that evil and bad stuff in the world can kind of be random, or at least independent of merit. We have a few, you know, his response was to say, well, I see the world doesn't work in a certain way. He came to terms with it and he accepted it. Here are a few other suggested responses to evil. Gemara Brachot 60b. So it was taught in the name of Rabbi Akiva. A person should always accustom himself to say, whatever the merciful one does is for the good. Odami Adam Ragil Lomar. A person should always accustom himself, called the Avi Rachmana Letavaved. So once Rabbi Akiva was walking on a road. He came to a certain place and requested room in an inn, but no one would give him lodging. He said, whatever the merciful one does is for the good. He went and stayed in an open field. He had with him a rooster, a donkey, and a lamp. The wind extinguished the lamp, a cat ate the rooster, and a lion ate the donkey. He said, whatever the merciful one does is for the good. All right, Hebrews say, gamzu letova, this is also for the good. That night, a band of robbers came to the town and took the inhabitants captives. He said to them, did I not tell you whatever the Holy One, blessed be He, does is for good? Which sounds a bit, you know, like narratively is kind of an insult to injury. But in terms of a theology, one important point to consider here is that Rabbi Akiva isn't saying that everything is for the good. He's saying that a person should accustom themselves to saying that, meaning he's trying to teach you, I believe, an attitude to say, to look at things positively and to have a certain degree of trust or faith. The reason why I think this works is mentioned in Maimonides and Guide to the Perplexed, Book 2, where he says, when Adam and Eve ate from the tree to know good and evil, he said that wasn't a reward, that was a punishment. Because if, in contrast, something can either be true or false, right? But when something, you know, you try to think about things in terms of good or bad, we can spin it. Anything bad can be spun for good, and anything good can be spun for bad. That is a matter of perspective. So it could well be Rabbi Akiva's attitude to things when bad things happen is try to spin it for good, right? Let's say, and try to look for the positives, look for the plus sides, right? Gemara in Brachot 5a, this should be Rava, right? Who was the same person who made the claim in Moed Katan 28a about, you know, life being up to Mazel, said, if a man sees that painful sufferings visit him, let him examine his conduct. For it is said, let us search and try our ways and return unto the Lord. If he examines and finds nothing objectionable, let him attribute it to the neglect of the study of Torah. For it is said, happy is the man who thou chastenest, O Lord, and thou teachest out of thy law. If he did attribute thus, and he still did not find this to be the cause, let him be sure that these are the chastisings of love. For it is said, for whom the Lord loves, he corrects. Kol asher yahav Hashem yochiach. Right? So Rava, who had said elsewhere that it's up to Mazel, gives you a different strategy here. Maybe the Mazel worked for him, for his own understanding. But now he's giving practical advice, as I'm reading it, not as much as Paskening theology, where he's not saying, here's why it's happening. He's trying to give people a way of looking at it. Because it's one thing to say, well, I see one person living a good life and another person living a bad life. You know what? I can rationalize that by saying, well, maybe it's not dependent on how good they are. But rather, it's up to Mazel. But it's a little bit different when if... So here, you know, the language seems to be Maradam Shizrim Ba'in Alav. That if someone sees bad stuff happening to him, right? And when bad things happen to an individual, it's going to feel a lot more worse than bad things happen to someone else, right? Your own tragedy, I mean, is going to be a lot more acute than the tragedy of someone else, right? So he gives you a few possibilities here. One is see if you did something wrong. Second is, maybe you didn't do enough good. Right? This isn't a psak halacha. He's not saying this is why it happened. He's giving different perspectives of ways of handling things. So first is, well, maybe I'm being punished because I sinned. And we saw a bunch of gemaras to that. But there are certain bad things that happen that seem, you know, no amount of sin would have been worth it. Like you think about, you know, the Holocaust being one extreme example, or, you know, other, you know, things that might happen is like anything that would happen to, say, a kid under the age of 13, for example, right? Where mitzvot wouldn't necessarily apply to him. So like, how would you have things like righteous, right? So otherwise, you know, maybe you should, there's more that you could do, right? These are means of human development. But he also leaves off with, you know, isurim shel ahava, afflictions of love, meaning it's a way of trying, you know, to cope in a way that why are you being afflicted, trying to teach people to accustom themselves to saying that whatever you're suffering has some sort of purpose behind it. And the Gemara then continues, what are these Yisurim Shalahava? So in this section we had, you know, a few different attitudes or strategies for how to cope with tragedy, basically. And one opinion is to assume that everything is for the good. Another is to take things that's a little more practical and say, well, maybe I can correct myself in some way. And otherwise, still try to spin it more positively. Because it's late and I'm going to, you know, go through the rest here. There are, you know, two qualifications. Now, up until now, I wanted to show there was a range. Like, there's a whole lot of different opinions on evil, ranging from, you know, super divine justice to randomness, a few different attitudes. My idea, as far as I know it's a chidush, is that the rabbinic approach to evil is basically you come up with your own idea of whatever works for you. There are two exceptions, though. In terms of limits on I call this limits on of Orthodox theology, is, you know, play off a book. The first thing that you're not allowed to do is impose your theology on God. So, example, Kedushin 39b. It was taught, Reb Jacob said, there's not a single precept in the Torah whose reward is stated at its side, which is not dependent on the resurrection of the dead. Thus, in connection with honoring parents, it is written that thy days be prolonged, and that it may go well with thee. In reference to the dismissal of the nest, Shiloh HaKein, you send the mother bird away to get the baby birds, that it may be well with thee, and thou mayest prolong thy days. Now, if one's father had said to him, send aloft and bring me young birds, and he ascends aloft, dismisses the dam and takes the young, and on return his fall is killed, where's this man's happiness? Where's this man's prolonging of days? But in order that it may be well with thee means on the day that is wholly good, and in order that thy days may be long, and on that day that is wholly long. I'll finish off this section here. Rabbi Yosef said, had Acher interpreted this verse, his daughter's son, he would not have sinned. Now, what happened with Acher? Some say he saw something of this nature. Others say he saw the tongue of Chutzpitz, the interpreter, dragged along by a swine, the mouth and other pearls licks the dust, he exclaimed. Thereupon he went forth and sinned. So according to this Gemara, Acher, Rabbi Elisha ben Avuya, the classical rabbinic heretic, saw this particular case where someone, you know, listens to his father to go up, climb the, his father tells him, go and do Shiluach HaKein, go and send the mother bird away, and in the process he falls down and dies, right, you know, afterwards. So one answer here is, well, divine justice is going to happen in the future. We saw that earlier about Olam Haba, but it's something that Acher said, wait a second, you know, this does, according to this narrative, doesn't really work. And if you look at the two verses, you've got from Exodus Shemot 20:11, honor your father and mother so that your days will be lengthened on the land which the Lord your God has given to you. Specifically, Allah demas sher shamlokecha noten la. Similar, you also have in Dvarim a similar language of on your father, what's it called? Kaveh tevicha v'yati mecha, right, etc. Right? Why? Leman yarichu yam mecha, leman yitav lach, so that your days will be lengthened and should be good for you. Al hatamash her shamo kecha notein lach, specifically on the land which your Lord and God had given to you. So assuming this happened, assuming Acher saw, and this is what compelled him to go off the derech, he was reading the verses literally. Right? To say that it's Olam Haba, some world to come, seems to contradict what the verse actually says. Yes, it's a drasha that says it refers to Yom Shekulor. Yes, you know, someone says the Man means to some day that's fully good. But it says Allah Adama Sher Shamal Kachanotin Lach. Pshat in the Pasuk. The verse, at plain sense, means if you do these things, you will live a long life on this earth. And yet, despite that, he's held accountable. Why? Because I think one limit is that if the world doesn't work the way that you think it ought to, even if it's because you've got a great read of the Bible, don't blame God for it. Right? Assuming that God is, you know, of infinite nature, then, you know, it's not an individual's place to say that, hey, you know what? This isn't working out. So that's one limit. The other is imposing theology on others. So remember what I said before, we saw this Gemara earlier, Shabbat 55b, on is there no death without sin? So an objection is raised. The ministering angels ask the Holy One, blessed be He, Master of the Universe, why did you impose the penalty of death on man? He said to them, I gave him an easy command and he violated it. The angels replied, but Moses and Aaron fulfilled the whole Torah and yet they died. The Lord responded, there's one event to the righteous and to the wicked. Right? So this follows in accordance with a particular Tanakh, for it was also taught, Rashom ben Elazar said, even Moses and Aaron died for their sins, because it is said, because you did not believe in me. Had you believed in me, your time to depart from this world would not have come. The opinion even then said, they would have lived forever if they hadn't sinned. Another objection is raised. Four died through the serpent's machinations. A reference to original sin here. Binyamin, the son of Jacob, Amram, father of Moses, Jesse, the father of David, and Kilab, the son of David. Who is the teacher of this passage? Shall we say that the Tana who taught about the ministering angels? If so, Moses and Aaron should be included. Therefore, it must be Hashem ben Elazar, which proves that there is death without sin and there is suffering without iniquity. The refutation of Ami is indeed a refutation. So, explaining just very briefly here, they give examples here of individuals who seem to have died even though they did not sin. Now, this last line of Tiyufta de Rav Ami Tiyufta is, to my knowledge, the only case where a theological statement in the Gemara is flat out rejected. When it says Tiyufta, you know, that's almost like you're wrong, end of discussion. And this is of rarity. I'd like to suggest that the reason why it had to be refuted is because when you say there is no death or suffering without sin, you're automatically saying that every single, you know, living person who died, you know, sinned somehow. In which case, what you're doing is passing judgment on every human being who has and will ever live. Right? It would somehow mean that why do infants die? Well, must be because of some sort of sin. You know, I guess if not their own, through someone else's. And that is a very troubling statement to make, because I don't think any mortal is in that position. Similarly, you had that kind of idea about, you know, no death without sin being, whatchamacallit? It was the opinion of someone named Eliphaz in the book of Eov, the book of Job. And on this, in 42:7 in the book of Job, God says something very interesting when he responds to him. It says, the Lord said these things to Job, and he said to Eliphaz the Temani, I am angry with you and your two friends. Ki lo dibartem elai nechona. You did not speak correctly of the Eov, as my servant Jacob has. Now this is a really weird... Right? So this is a really weird line here. He didn't say they were wrong. He said, "Lo dibartem elai nechona." You did not speak correctly. Meaning, theologically, if I'm going to say, why are bad things happening to you because you sin, I've got plenty of sources that can back that up. I've got the second paragraph of Shema, right, which talks about reward and punishment. I've got a bunch of Gemaras here that could support it. But even so, God's response is, "Lo dibartem elai nechona." You did not speak correctly. And why? And I'd like to suggest, going back to Pirkei Avot 4:18, Shem ben Elazar used to say, do not appease your fellow in the time of his anger. Do not comfort him while he's dead like before him. Do not question him in the time of his vow. Do not try to see him in the time of his disgrace. There's a certain moment where if someone's in a period of mourning, no answer is going to suffice. Eov was in a period of mourning. When you're in a period of mourning, you don't want a theological discussion. You're feeling sad, you're feeling miserable, you're sort of overwhelmed. You don't want someone to give you a stack of makara and start giving you a 3-hour shiur on what evil is. Because no matter what you say, you're going to be imposing your theology on other people. You're going to try to say, well, you know, it's fine that this is how I look at the world, but that might not be how you look at the world. And I think that's, you know, God's name of Lodi Barta Alay Nechona. It's not your place to tell someone else how God works. It's not your place to tell someone else, oh, that person died because they sinned. So, Bikitsur, or listen.
You could tell them other times, though, or just not when they're...
I think the main point is this. Is something, if you're talking about a Jewish attitude to evil, you've got a lot of stuff on the books to choose from. I think they're enough of a range that you as an individual can find something to grasp. What I can do is I can teach different possibilities. What I cannot do is to impose my ideas on God, meaning if the world doesn't work the way I think it ought to, that's not God's fault. I also can't impose it on other people. I can share with someone, hey, here are some of my ideas, here's how I look at things. But there's a very big difference between me sharing my own experience and my own thoughts and me telling you personally, definitively, here's why bad stuff is happening to you. Here's why bad stuff is happening to them. Because that's imposing my theology on other people. That's me acting as a judge, which I have no business doing. Right? And if you think about, you know, a very nice approach to theology here, I think it works very well. You have a range of things that you can believe, but your beliefs are not mandated on other people. And for something like evil, where there usually is a very heightened emotional sensitivity to, it's a very important idea to have, such that when people do try to give consolation, should do so with a great deal of humility behind it, and certainly not try to speak for God and give answers on his
behalf. They tell you sometimes to rebuke people for their own good.
Well, rebuking is something else. I mean, there's interesting giving mussar versus saying, hey, you know, why did some bad stuff happen to you? Because, oh, it's because you sinned. There's a huge, huge difference there, right? I can educate people about Shabbos, but it's different between saying, oh, yeah, why did you lose your family in a car crash? Because you didn't keep kosher? I can't say that, right? And I don't think anyone can. And I think that's where God says, Lo dibartam lai nechona. Even if you maybe feel logically, you know, justified in having that belief, it's not your place to tell that to someone and not your place to judge someone on those particular terms. Great.